Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the generous support of the Icon Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 24.
Okay, I'd like to just pursue the topic of how KIFs grow. In the article, in the 1992 article, you talk about how they tended to grow through overhead and not through their expertise. Certainly matches my experience with military organizations that that grow.
Yeah. They do both, though, right? Both kinds of growth occur.
But I would say that from my perspective, I've tended to see the overhead growing faster than the expertise in a lot of cases. And then when I start looking at, especially now because of, say, our current situation and the situation that was also present in the 1990s, where downsizing was very much in the conversation, the tendency is to try to target overhead, I think, and say that overhead is bad. We want to get more efficient and to try to preserve the expertise, but it seems like that approach rarely succeeds in creating a equally effective smaller organization. At least in the context of, say from where I'm coming from in military organizations, do you share that view? And if so, why do you think that is? Or if you don't share that view, what might be different about military organizations, perhaps, that it's different from what you see?
One of the first things I published a long, long time ago, over 50 years ago, was about organizational growth. And one of the little pieces of writing I found when I was writing that was an argument that organizations tend always to grow foolishly. I called this disappearing economies. You look at what you've got going on. You say, well, we wouldn't have to buy more of that. We could just buy more of something that would be profitable or useful. A typical thing for a business firm is you have fixed costs and variable costs, and it always looks as if the fixed costs are fixed. And thus, you can expand your variable costs, get more revenue without having to expand your fixed costs, and your percentage of revenue, your profit, goes up, right?
Right.
Except that those fixed costs are only fixed in the very short run. They're not fixed in the long run. In the long run, all costs are variable. So in the long run, you eventually have to match everything back up again. I think this works on both ways on knowledge-intensive firms. They look and they say, well, if we just added a couple more secretaries, we wouldn't have to hire more lawyers or we wouldn't have to hire more engineers. And that's probably true in the short term. But eventually, you're going to need more lawyers and more engineers, to balance out the cost of these extra secretaries. So eventually, you're going to be back on some sort of a balanced growth curve. Now, I believe that the way in which most big organizations operate is in kind of a seesaw pattern, where they're constantly seeing opportunities that call for change or challenges that call for change or threats or something. And they're constantly trying to address those things. But none of those efforts that they make have a long-term life about them. All of them eventually turn into another problem as time goes on. And so they are constantly having to discover new problems and solve them anew. In a sense, you're constantly trying to build an organization as a rigid structure in a turbulent environment. And you know that that's not going to work, but you're trying to create a little bit more rigidity in this to do things the way we used to do them or to do things more efficiently. But in the longer term, you can't do them more efficiently because the technologies are going to change, the social system around you is going to change, and you're going to have to go to something entirely different. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Because also another factor that I see a lot of is trade-offs, where if we want to grow an organization, you end up having to go through a bureaucratic process to compete for that ability to grow against other organizations that are trying to grow, which tends to lend itself to fighting for positions you can win as much as fighting for positions that provide this expertise.
Which may not be the ones you can win may not be the most valuable things you could do, but they're the ones you have a good argument for.
And that comes up in the exemplar of the Wachtell Lipton Corporation, which I thought was very insightful when Bill was relating. They actually made the choice, not necessarily not to grow. I mean, you were talking about that earlier about some of those choices, but they to turn away customers and kind of focus on what they did best, as opposed to just pure revenue generation. And because of the quality of their work and service that they provide, they can charge whatever they want. So it's actually not, their focus is not on growth per se. It's about the kind of work that they do and the value that they add, which is not the way that a lot of organizations think about growing. So they actually were thinking about, what are we not going to do, or what kind of work won't we do because of our different focus on the expertise that we have.
Now, the converse, comes to downsizing or reducing, that's a different question from what I see, because one of the things that I see us gravitating towards is the salami slice, which if you think of organizations growing perhaps foolishly, that doesn't always sound like a very, very effective way of trying to reduce structure if you're trying to keep an organization intact, because it's really, really hard to, you know, no matter where you're going to cut this salami slice. And by the way, salami slice refers to take all of your subordinate units and cut the same percentage across the board, so you avoid making or you keep the downsizing effort simple.
Well, not only that, Tom, so that's a really good point. So it's also referred to as belt tightening. Remember, everybody cuts by 10% or 5%. But it often seems like organizations are in a hurry to do this for financial survival, or they delay too long or something. So it's one of the things I think it's attractive, it's simplicity and it's speed. And I guess those are related because then you can cut right away and say, okay, we made progress. And the harder choices like Wachtell Lipton, you know, was making about what kind of work do we want to do, you're not making those choices.
You sort of make them after the fact. You look at what happened. What are you left with? And okay, well, how do you make this work and then rebuild after the fact, which can be very painful?
High-level personnel often underestimate the value in low-level personnel. When I was in Milwaukee, one of the local firms was called the Will Ross Corporation. It was a sort of a pharmaceutical supplier. Hospitals would call up and order bandages or whatever from the Will Ross Corporation. They were purchased by G.D. Searle. G.D. Searle appointed a new head. So the former head of Will Ross Corporation was replaced by an executive from Chicago. And the guy from Chicago didn't want to move to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So he set out to move the company to a different place. And he appointed a committee to study all the locations. And they investigated Atlanta and maybe San Diego and ended up moving to Dallas. And they decided that in doing this, the top personnel, the Will Ross Corporation, would pay all their moving costs. And some of the middle personnel, they would pay their moving costs. But the low-level personnel, they could have their jobs if they would move to Dallas at their own expense, but the Will Ross Corporation would not pay for them to do that.
Ouch.
They moved to Dallas. 6 months later, they were out of business, totally.
Wow.
Because when the customers called up, they wanted Harriet. They wanted Mary. They dealt with Mary for the last 30 years. If Mary was gone, who are they going to talk to? So there are all kinds of, what would you call it, interpersonal relationships and familiarity and so forth that were built into that organization at a low level that the senior executives vastly underestimated in terms of what's it as a resource for the corporation.
And we experience some similar things when we realign units or headquarters that are located at a particular base. If we decide that we're going to, say, close a base, that's in order to save money, and you have this this headquarters that is, you know, been in that particular base for a long, long period of time. Now you're going to uproot them and move them to another location. A lot of times there's a lot of valid reasons why different individuals would not want to move at that base. And the same thing kind of happens. There's a lot of relationships that might, even at the middle management level, a lot of relationships that end up having to get lost and get repaired. Mm-hmm. And the good news is that a lot of times the organization figures it out in the long haul, but clearly that adds to the disruption, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the move.
Yeah, there's a lot of knowledge embedded in the everyday routines that organizations carry out. It isn't just in the databases, but it's in the procedures. It's in the manuals. There's knowledge in those manuals. When people come in, they acquire that knowledge by going to some sort of training class or reading the manual or whatever it is. And so that's the organization's memory is in those forms. The low-level personnel are the ones who are most familiar with those routines. They perform those routines on an everyday basis. If you destroy the manuals, you destroy the knowledge. But if you lose the personnel, you also destroy the knowledge.
So what do you think might be some things you'd advise, say, today's senior leaders if, say, for example, we're facing a similar downsizing? How do we do a little bit better at sustaining our organizational memory?
Well, of course, organizations are constantly trying to get this stuff written down and recorded so that if they make some changes and they lose somebody, they won't lose everything. But it's almost impossible to get it all. So I guess the big issue is not whether or not you can keep it all or whatever, but whether you can somehow evaluate it wisely before you do something drastic. Incremental changes are often a good idea, right? You can't always make incremental changes, but insofar as you can, try something out and see if it'll work before you commit a lot of resources to it.
And perhaps also do more to incentivize keeping the lower level personnel who maintain that organizational memory.
Yeah, I don't think most organizations are as nutty as the Will Ross Corporation was. But that was pretty bad, yeah.
What do you think the challenges are for knowledge-intensive firms today? We've mentioned the issue about big data, so I wanted to open up this question a bit more. And especially with a view to figuring out how these challenges have developed over time.
Well, I think two things strike me, and maybe three. The first thing is organizations have to unlearn as well as learn. You see, back in the 1950s, when people first started talking about organizational learning, everybody assumed that learning was a good thing. But of course, you learn bad things as well as good things. You learn useless things as well as useful things. And partly that's because you don't know what the future is going to bring. And so you're operating on the basis of what you know today. But the future may not develop the way you expect, and consequently, the thing you thought was going to be useless turns out to be valuable, or vice versa. With two colleagues, I spent 10 years studying organizations that get into really serious trouble. We called them organizations facing crises, but we're talking about essentially business firms that are on the brink of bankruptcy. There was a university that lost half of its students over the summer. When the students went home in June, there were twice as many as there were when they came back in September. You can imagine what kind of a shock that is to the system. One of the things we observed in this was that organizations have to go through a period of unlearning before they're ready to learn new stuff. They have to go through unlearning because so much of their knowledge is embedded in things that are difficult to change. Their knowledge is embedded in respect for the leaders. That is, they think the leader knows what he's doing and they're willing to follow him. But what if that leader is in fact giving incorrect orders, is screwing things up? It takes a long time before the subordinates realize that that's the situation and begin to do something about it. Or suppose that some of their procedures, their former suppliers or something, have begun producing really bad stuff. Imagine like the airbag problem in the automobile industry. So you discover that your supplier isn't doing a very good job, or it's doing a really bad job. How long does it take you to figure that out and to do something about it? Organizations have a real rigidity about getting rid of obsolete knowledge, obsolete ways of doing things, before they're ready to consider the possibility they need to adopt new things. And individual people don't have this characteristic so much as organizations do. And it's because organizations embed so much of their knowledge in training programs, in personnel selection rules, books, in databases, you know, they rigidify to a large extent. Well, I've forgotten what the other point was that I was going to
thank you very
talk
much.
About. So, I better quit.
I had a couple of more points to raise. So my second point concerned this idea that knowledge is not in people. And I know that we've kind of mentioned this before. So I wanted to expand a bit on that, just to give a bit of definitions and distinctions with regard to that point. Because we do think that knowledge can be codified and it is available out there. But then there is this kind of aura around knowledge, which places it within the person, within the human being's minds.
Sure, but you've used Wikipedia.
Yes.
Yeah, right?
Many times, I'm sure. I have.
Yeah.
I admit.
Yeah, and as the last decade or so has evolved, we've been doing this more and more and more. The whole world is becoming much more dependent on knowledge that is not in people. If you get an illness, isn't one of the first things you do go online and Google the name of the illness to see or your symptoms?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, but even before you go to the doctor, you ask questions. You know what you ought to be asking, right?
All right. So it seems like it's a mix, right? I think it's not either or, right? Because you were talking about embedded knowledge. And Wikipedia is a really good example. In fact, one of the things I've noticed now on Wikipedia, as an aside, is many of the articles now, there'll be at the top of the article, there'll be a critique of the information that's in the article, and it'll say what needs to be done to improve the article, because they didn't used to have that quite so prominently featured.
And
so I think there's this, it's a maybe balance is the right way to say it, but there's multiple ways that the knowledge gets encoded, because I think it was in your article you were talking about I forget exactly. I know it wasn't in the 92 article about anthropomorphizing, you know, organizations, and that might have been the Kerriman article. Mm-hmm. You know, the risk of doing that, you know, getting a little bit over, you know, carried away, such that there's this organizational knowledge or organizational memory, with apologies to Demetrius, since that was his thesis topic. So it seems like you have to have both, right? Because, of course, the social knowledge and that knowledge about the flow of information, that's actually exceedingly difficult to embed in procedures. But at the same point, these routines help process the flow of knowledge. So I think you need both, actually.
You get a little more flexibility with the knowledge that people have. They're more relaxed about unlearning what they did wrong. That is, acknowledging that what they were doing wasn't so good than organizations are. And they're a little more eager to pick up new things than organizations are. Organizations usually have to go through procedures to decide that something deserves to be in the manuals or deserves to be kept.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. So I was thinking a bit out loud, that this also kind of ties in neatly with the distinction between information and knowledge, but there's also in some ways the knowledge about the use of the information, so this idea of processing it, that plays an important role.
They're just different layers of this stuff. It's not like knowledge is one thing and information is one other thing, but they blend into each other, and there are different kinds in each category.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting earlier you had said that knowledge and information were sort of a converging, you know, when you were talking about Big Blue and the search routines and stuff. And I remember earlier in my working career, people would say, oh, those are two different things, right? You had this all this information and data and process transactions, for example, and then knowledge is knowing about it. And I thought that was interesting insight to say, well, you know, with the tools and such that we're using, they're not quite so distinct as we might have once thought they were. Or maybe the distinction was just artificial all along.
We have had a general problem in all of science. It occurs in chemistry and physics and biology and sociology and psychology, of building bridges between micro-level phenomena and macro-level phenomena. For example, you can study what a bug eats and how the bug moves around on the ground or whatever. But then you try to take that knowledge, that understanding, and expand it out into the behavior of an ecosystem in, say, the Western United States, and it just won't make any sense for you. Well, they are supposedly linked in some way, but you can't go from one to the other in either direction very well. I mean, you can talk about the forest. You can talk about the trees in the forest. At some point, you're down to the leaves on the trees, and it's almost impossible to go down there from the whole concept of a forest covering California or something. And vice versa, you start with the characteristic of a leaf, you cannot get up to the characteristics of the forest very easily. And the same happens here with the little bits of information that get processed. It's hard to see how you build a theory that will encompass both the little pieces of information and the big databases filled with knowledge.
Yeah, that's a good observation. Because I struggle with that myself, where I just wonder, how do you go from this micro phenomenon to make these kind of broad statements? And yet that seems, many papers or research, it seems like that's what, you know, they think they're supposed to be doing, I guess. I'm not really sure, but I'm not sure it's all that informative when they do try to do that.
Yeah. People have been trying to do this, of course, for a very long time. But the fact that it happens in all different scientific fields in a consistent way, just, we just live in a very complicated environment, and it has many, many layers. I am constantly amazed. I studied physics in college, and when I was in college, we were taught that there are only three elementary particles, right?
I remember
electrons,
that.
Neutrons, and positrons, right? Well, guess what? Turns out all of that was wrong. It was not facts. It was just wrong.
In fact, when I got my nuclear physics master's degree, I had made that transition, and I wondered why my physics professors never talked about those sub-elementary particles. I mean, it was like they didn't exist to them. And this was in the early 90s when there was widespread knowledge of quarks and, you know, these other subatomic particles. And so he just kind of looked at me when I said, how come we never talk about those things? I didn't get it. So I basically had to answer my own question.
Right.
If we have, in the general world of organizations today, organizations that are moving towards an increasingly knowledge-intensive form or characteristics, if the knowledge-intensive aspect is becoming increasingly important?
Oh, boy, yes, I think so. It depends, though, on which economy you're in. There has been a general progression, and I don't think it's inevitable, but it happens to be the way it is, that countries around the world have started out being primarily agricultural, and then for the European countries, the United States and Japan, they began moving into manufacturing about 160 or 70 years ago. Maybe about 1950, the U.S. began moving out of manufacturing. First the manufacturing replaced the agriculture, and now services have replaced the manufacturing. This is, of course, a major factor in the election of Donald Trump, because the people who used to work in manufacturing have lost their jobs, and they don't see a ready way to get another job because the delivery of services, of course, there are low-level services that don't pay very well, but the kinds of services that you can deliver that pay a good salary tend to involved a lot of expertise. So the U.S. has migrated from agriculture through manufacturing toward the delivery of high-level services. That's also been happening in Europe, and it's been happening in Japan. And as that, the migration occurred, the agriculture has moved out of these countries into other places, although not entirely. See, part of the agricultural replacement occurred because of rising productivity in agriculture.
Right, machinery and stuff.
Yeah, machinery and just better understanding of how crops work and better ideas about what to do to fertilize or to improve soil and whatever. So the U.S. productivity in agriculture is, we're probably producing more food than we ever did in the 19th century, but it's not taking us anywhere near as many people to do it. Likewise, in manufacturing, robots have been replacing human beings in factories all over the place. And we're probably, well, no, I know we are. I recently read that we're producing more manufacturing in 2016 than ever before in the history of the United States. And yet, there are lots and lots of people who have lost their jobs in manufacturing because machines can do it more reliably and quicker and cheaper than the people can. So this is going to happen, of course, in services as well. But there's some kinds of services. I think the plumbers, electricians are always going to have some jobs, don't you?
Absolutely. Although I got a ride from an Uber driver last night, come to the hotel, who used to be a pipe fitter. And he had worked in oil refineries. He was describing some of the places he'd worked and been a bit of a gypsy moving around. And it actually worked in the Oak Ridge National Laboratories enrichment plants. So now he's driving Uber because there are no pipe fitting jobs. He couldn't find pipe fitting jobs where he wanted to work. And so, I think, he's sort of a textbook case of, and then he's definitely not making as an Uber driver what he was making as a, he didn't say it, but I just know the wage rates are different. So he's definitely not making. And one comment about your observation that a lot of the service, so automation is moving into the services industry. So you get these people say, oh, well, we'll have self-driving cars. And so that'll change who's driving. And of course you see Uber and Lyft and those interested in, how do I get I take a person completely out of the loop and I'll have a robot car drive them around. That is interesting.
Two countries have been really very farsighted about this, India and China. This happened about 15, 20 years ago. They each invested a lot of money into higher education. India focused on software engineering, and China focused on hardware engineering. And by 2008, and you can show the statistics really clearly, American companies stopped hiring Indians and Chinese to come to America to do engineering, and instead they began giving contracts to companies in China and India to do the engineering. That is, they began shipping the jobs, the jobs in the form of contracts rather than jobs in the form of people across these borders. So those two countries have staked a big hunk of their economy on the development of expertise in their economy.
Well, and in fact, what you see China doing, they've made I don't know whether it's a business decision or you'd call it a national decision, but they'll often say, oh, we'll manufacture jet engine parts or take this contract, but we want the expertise as well. They want to develop. So they're very focused, like you said, on getting access to the expertise because they want to do more than just be extra hands and legs or arms.
Absolutely. Right. Of course, that raises competitive issues about is it really smart for the United States to be totally dependent on China for the design of computer hardware?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, U.S. Navy and I'm sure other members of DOD have issues where we'll have a big vendor for some server or switch or something for a network, and then they'll get bought by a Chinese company, and then all of a sudden we have to look for an alternate vendor because of the concerns about the data that's being moved.
Our microprocessor industry is nearly all the memory production is outside the U.S., right?
Yes.
And there's still some microprocessor in the U.S., but all that level of manufacturing is gone.
I have a question that the it basically comes from the Karaman paper that was looking at your paper and its implications. But Karaman makes the observation that, or actually a claim, that he says, quote, "The widely observed fact that even top executives are curiously powerless when it comes to critical decision-making regarding knowledge work." And then he goes on to make some observations about that. But it seems like to me like the findings of your paper are more nuanced than that, that it's not, it's just that the top executives are powerless. It changes the power dynamic. But I think powerless seems like it would be too strong a word. I'm certainly not asking it to criticize Dr. Karaman, but I'm just wondering what your perspective is on that.
Well, my reaction to reading that was the Aerospace Corporation with its 3 levels inside and its 7 levels outside. Exactly who is the boss there, right?
Right.
The fact is that everybody in aerospace has a great deal of responsibility. Even the third level down are highly skilled engineers with very high salaries who know a lot about what they're doing, right?
Right.
And they manage themselves to a very large degree. This idea that bosses should supervise workers began dying in 1945, approximately, and it's been dying ever since. Modern workers don't want to be supervised. Modern workers know what they're proud of their expertise. They've studied a lot, and they can supervise themselves. And the problem is really how to incentivize them, how to reward them, how to align their goals with the goals of the organization.
Okay, I think that's a good observation, because as a supervisor myself in many knowledge intensive kinds of activities, that was a challenge where you realize it's not just that you don't know exactly what the other person is doing. It's just they know so much more than you. You have to try to convince them to share enough of it with you so you can supervise them. But also in a way where you're not, like you said, you're not directing them what to, telling them what to do, because it's really not practical. They know what they need to do, and therefore it's more about. So I consider my role as a manager kind of important for supporting them, making sure they could be free from other kinds of distractions or impositions, so they could focus on the work they like to do.
One company, my French friend Philippe and I studied, was ST Micro, which is one of the great big microprocessing, microchip manufacturing companies in the world. And they have facilities all around the world, and they got into a system where they were passing jobs from one hemisphere to another so they could operate on 24 hours. And so they had engineers all around the world, and they had purchasing agents all around the world, and so forth. And at some point, they decided to create task forces to work on specific projects by building the task forces out of people in all around their different facilities. And they realized that they needed somebody who could kind of keep everything hanging together. And they decided that only senior vice presidents or vice president level people. Every one of these task forces should have somebody like a vice president level person who's sort of monitoring what's going on and keeping track. So now they've got task forces made up of, say, one senior vice president and 20 or 30 engineers working on a problem and developing solutions. But where's middle management? It turned out that the middle managers were left out of the task forces and they didn't know what was going on. Junior people were talking to senior people directly without a need to go through the hierarchy.
Wow. So that, did they think that had implications for how many middle managers they needed or just what they should be?
The middle managers thought it had some implications. They were very upset about this.
I imagine they did.
Well, what are they going to do about it? The most efficient solution is for the person who's doing the work to talk to the guy who's wants it done.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Well, that sounds similar to some of the stuff IBM does, or I've heard that they do, where they'll set up these global teams of experts and it gives them the ability to work on problems 24/7, kind of around the clock.
Right, right.
And they'll have these handoffs going on. And what's interesting in the U.S. Navy shipyards, for example, I'm not being critical, but we try to actually minimize the number of jobs that go around the clock, because the turnovers get very difficult. And so then, of course, you know, that you might say, well, you know, you need to work, do better at that, at the turnover process, as opposed to saying we just don't want to do that kind of work.
Well, I've co-authored with a fellow who has spent a lot of time recently in Indonesia, and we have found that really efficient. Because about the time I'm ready to shut down for the day, he's ready to start up.
Oh, that's great.
And by the time I get up in the morning, he's done his iteration, and I could start where he left off.
Wow, yeah, that's very productive.
So we used to do that when I was in the Navy, because I was on Pearl Harbor, and the guys in Norfolk would start and then hand over the task at the end of the day. So you could actually do that. So that network model that you discussed, where you've got the senior vice presidents working with the first line engineers,
right,
turns out to be a growing model. I actually was this week at a client trying to educate them on how to do that, because uh-huh. their initiatives are stuck, and they were looking, because they were really very hierarchical, and they couldn't understand why that wasn't getting the results that they wanted.
Right.
And so that's pretty interesting to hear that. And my partner actually works for the world's largest chip maker, and she was explaining that to them as well. So question then, you know, is the balance between the hierarchy and the network, and how do you find that balance?
Well, in our studies of firms that got into crises and faced bankruptcy or failure of some sort, one of the big problems is that when they get into trouble, it's not everyday operations, but when they get into serious trouble and they know they're screwing up and they have to do something different, top management tries to centralize control. They want to say, we know what's going on, we're going to be in charge, but they're technologically obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
They're socially obsolete. The last time they talked to a customer is 20 years ago. The last time they actually produced something on a factory floor was 20 years ago, right? So they don't really know how today's world works. And they find that a very difficult thing to admit to themselves.
Yes, so that was also something interesting about this firm I was with, because at the executive level, they don't turn off the outside touches. So my contact to this firm was at the managing director level, and I happened to touch his business in a variety of places, and I would send him texts, and after three uh-huh. or four, I asked him, you know, am I bothering you? He goes, no, we treasure these. And then spending the last week with their basically SVPs and VPs, and they all apparently have those, they've created those networks because it's their way to not be obsolete, like what you've talked about. Whether they realized it implicitly or explicitly, they've tried to take that behavior on. So I guess that explains their market position, which is number one.
It's been a very enjoyable and interesting conversation with you, Bill. And I think one of the things that stood out to me when I was reading about the descriptions that of your observations at working at these different firms, particularly about the flow of knowledge, because I thought that was really interesting, was that knowledge-intensive firms seem to be very messy, that's my word for it, contradictory and challenging places to work. There's all this, you know, these different power dynamics and this idea about how much do you write down versus taking care of your experts or letting your experts walk out the door. And particularly at what I call the high-end organizations that you studied, the RAND and the Arthur D. Little, and I'm sure you had studied others or talked to others, but makes me start thinking, well, what do you think the implications of this kind of messy, contradictory, challenging aspects of the work are for retaining the expertise and kind of motivating employees? Do you think it's the knowledge just drives all that, or you think that there requires a different approach to management?
Well, it clearly requires a different approach to management. One of our longtime friends is a consultant for one of those really big consulting companies, well, the Big Four, I think they're called now, right?
Right.
And she's taken a special interest in the problems of how to motivate and manage the people that they deal with. And of course, part of what's going on is that families are changing. A lot of people, not all of them, are asking for more balanced family responsibilities where both husband and wife take some responsibility for the kids and for the household management because the women are working as well as the men, and often they're better paid than their husbands. They're working at a distance. They don't go to an office every day. Even this friend of mine, when she goes to her office, it's not the same room that it was the last time she went to her office.
She goes
to the receptionist at the front of the building, and they say, well, your office for today is going to be such and such room. And I guess her stuff moves there somehow magically overnight or whatever.
Or they bring their files in a car. I think that's called hoteling.
Yeah. So all these characteristics of work have become very loose. It's like people are connected to their organizations less and less by interpersonal face-to-face contact and more with some sort of formal contractual relationships in which people are autonomous. And if they don't do their work, you might not know about it for a while. I had a student in one of my MBA classes in New York whose supervisor was in Argentina and who in turn supervised a group of people in the Midwest of the U.S., right?
That's quite the link.
it is, right? And their face-to-face contact was virtually non-existent, right? Maybe they saw each other once or twice a year, but that was it.
Right.
So our whole workplace is changing dramatically, and it's really hard to predict what's going to happen with our workforce.
Well, and I think that's the one of the reasons why the value of the article is so enduring, is that it's not about, you know, do this or do that. It was more a description of the kinds of things that were happening. And even though anything is written as a snapshot in time, I thought one of the great insights was it provided a nice description of the kinds of flows of things that happen. And so what we're seeing today is maybe some different emphases and some changes, but the same kinds of things are going on. There's just different environmental forces.
Good.
So thank you very much.
Well, it's been nice talking to you folks.
And thanks to Joe and Miranda and Tom for participating with us today. And that's all for episode 24. Thank you for listening. If you would like to find out more about these readings, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, we have now started a weekly newsletter highlighting the episodes, relevant management, and organizational studies events, as well as all sorts of other interesting things. You can subscribe to that with just your email on our website. The newsletter comes out every Wednesday. Meanwhile, I look forward to welcoming you next week here on Talking About Organizations.